Has anyone ever had a lesson that they had to learn the hard way? Anybody want to give a good example? No. I tried to look up a good example, and I found a forum that was an internet forum that listed a bunch of times people did it. A lot of them were not good examples, and I'm like, no, but several more okay examples. So here's just the summary of a couple of them. There's the young adult who thought that they still had the flexibility of a teenager, so they tried to do the splits, and they were, walking funny for the next week. There's the person with the hard-to-pronounce last name, who when they picked up the phone because someone was calling them, they butchered the last name, and they got really upset and angry at this person. You're a telemarketer, quit calling me. And they find out it's actually a potential employer who's trying to schedule them for an interview. Yeah. Then there's just the stereotype braggart who, thinks they're the best, lets everyone know it, and then they get confronted with someone who's a whole lot better than they are at whatever that is. Some lessons we wish we didn't have to learn the hard way, right? There are some lessons, though, that you kind of, maybe not the hard way, but they have to be learned the long and steady way, or maybe a painful way. As it's pretty cool, tomorrow is the scheduled date for when my son's going to be born, unless he comes tonight. It's happening tomorrow. And so, yeah, I'm excited about it. I don't know if I say thank you to that. I don't know. But Ephraim's going to grow. I'm going to blink, and he's going to be learning to walk pretty quick, like before I even realize it, right? And what happens when you're learning to walk? What do you do a lot? You fall. You fall, and you get hurt, and you topple over. And thankfully, little kids are made of rubber. Sometimes it seems like it. But he's going to fall a lot. But it's still worth learning the lesson of how to walk, right? The pain of falling is worth the lesson. My daughter's in kindergarten. She's still finishing up the lessons of her ABCs, right? She knows most of them, uppercase and lowercase. But there's three or so that she just always gets stuck on. Like, I think it's the letter D and the letter Q. She just always has trouble with those. And there's another one. A Y is her other one that she's got problems with. It takes repetition and slow and steady and just working in those more and more and more. And she'll get the letters down, right? And even though she gets annoyed with me and I get annoyed with her because we've been working on something forever, but it's worth the study and the lessons that she'll be able to learn to read, right? And it's worth that time that it takes to put into it. There are lessons we learn differently. Sometimes there are hard lessons. Sometimes we learn the lessons hardly. Sometimes they're only through slow and steady work or through pain. There is a lesson we're going to talk about that Abraham, an incredible guy, he learned, and he messed up a lot along the way of learning this lesson. But thankfully, he learned it by the point we're going to talk about in Scripture. And he learned this lesson of how to trust in God. That's the lesson he learned. This guy is Abraham. You've probably heard of him, right? Like, I think most everyone's heard of him. If you haven't, he had many sons and father Abraham. I'm one of them. Maybe so are you. Not everyone is, though, just if you're a Christian, is what Scripture says. But he's kind of a big deal, right? Abraham is a pretty big deal. He's the father of Judaism. He's the father of all the Jews. He's the father, in many senses, of Christianity in some ways. Today, we're going to start talking about Abraham by looking at what was probably those pinnacle point where he passed this test of, yes, I do trust in God no matter what. And the story is found in Genesis chapter 22, if you would like to turn there to follow along with us. Before reading, I'll set the stage for the story, though. Remember that Abraham was promised by God to be the father of many what? Many nations. And what is usually a prerequisite for being the father of many nations? Having at least one kid, right? Usually. Or else you can't father many nations if you don't have any kids. And so that was his problem. He and his wife were very aged, and Sarah was actually barren. But God kept promising to Abraham, you're going to be the father of many nations. Don't worry, you got this. And Abraham was probably, I don't know what he was thinking at many times. But finally, though, when Abraham is 100 years old and his wife is 90 years old, think about that for a minute. 100 years old and 90 years old, older than many people live, then they have their son. Now, that's a genuine miracle baby, right? Like, I'm pretty sure biological things have happened by then. That's a miracle baby. It's just a miracle that they have a son then. And they name him Isaac. Abraham's got his boy. He's lived for 100 years, finally has a son. And the son has been promised to bring blessings to the entire world. And you can believe that promise, right? Because otherwise they wouldn't have a boy because there was a miracle baby. And so if it's a miracle baby, obviously something supernatural is involved. And you can probably trust the promises that come with the child. And then we get to Genesis chapter 22. And God calls this a test. Abraham is tested here in Genesis chapter 22. And I'll read verses 1 through 8 to start. After these things, God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham. And he said, here I am. He said, take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you. So Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, and took two of his young men with him and his son Isaac. He cut the wood for the burnt offering and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. On the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the place from afar. Then Abraham said to his young men, stay here with the donkey. I and the boy will go over there and worship and will come again to you. And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac, his son, and he took in his hand the fire and the knife. So they went both of them together. And Isaac said to his father, Abraham, my father. And he said, here I am, my son. He said, behold, look, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering? Abraham said, God will provide for himself the lamb for a burnt offering, my son. So they went both of them together. That comment then towards the beginning where it says, so Abraham rose early, do you think it's because he woke up early, or do you think it's because he just got out of bed because he wasn't sleeping the whole night? My thought, he probably just didn't sleep a wink that entire night. He had this promised son that he'd waited for an entire lifetime, longer than most lifetimes. God just told him to do what to that son? To kill him. To give him up to God. To sacrifice him as a burnt offering. Now, as has been mentioned before, not today, but in the past, several other ancient religions practiced child sacrifice back then. And so it may not have been totally out of the blue for Abraham to get this from God, but you would hope that this God would be different. It's probably what Abraham's thinking, right? He's spent time with God. He's actually like, God's like walked up to his house and talked to him. He's talked to God. He should know that God is different than other gods. And so why is he asking me to do this? But he goes through these motions to do it anyway, right? They cut firewood enough to consume a whole human body, and so it was a lot of wood, right? And then he lays it on Isaac. And so if Isaac can carry that much wood, is he a little boy? Is he old enough that there's now a lifetime of memories that Abraham has of his child? And they're not just, it's also a friendship relationship probably as well. And they journey for 3 days. I don't know what it was like for Isaac, but you can probably guess what it was like for Abraham, right? The 3 days of walking towards the mountain. And then did you catch what Abraham said to his servants, though? What did he say to his servants? He said, stay here with the donkey, Isaac and I will worship, and then who will come back to you? Who did he say would come back? He said, we would come back. He said, I and the boy will go up here, and then we will come back, is what he said. He didn't say, and I'm only going to come back. He said, we. Was that just wishful thinking? Was maybe Abraham was like, ah, God's testing me. That's it. So I just have to go through the motions, and then everything's going to be okay. Or maybe Abraham was lying so that Isaac wouldn't, you know, run away, or the servants wouldn't stop him. What do you think was happening? In Hebrews, we actually have the answer of what was going through his head. Not in the book of Genesis, but way later in the Bible, in the book of Hebrews, chapter 11, we get the answer. Chapter 11, verses 17 through 19, it says, by faith Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises was in the act of offering up his only son, of whom it was said, through Isaac shall your offspring be named. He considered that God was able even to raise him from the dead, from which, figuratively speaking, he did receive him back. So Abraham considered, he believed that God would do what for Isaac? He'd raise him from the dead. Think about it, though. It makes sense. If he could have a baby at the age of 100, his wife 90, if God can figure that out, he can probably figure out me doing this thing that he's asked him, right? So he knows that Isaac was supposed to be the son who was going to have all these promises. He also knows God told him to kill Isaac. And so he had to reconcile the two. And really, the only way to reconcile the two in Abraham's mind was, look, God's going to raise him from the dead. And so he was willing to go through with it because he trusted in God, right? He's willing to just go through and do what God says, even if it sounded a bit crazy. So he started to pass this test. And here's the rest of the story. Verses 9 through 12. When they came to the place of which God had told him, Abraham built the altar there and laid the wood in order and bound Isaac his son and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then Abraham reached out his hand and took the knife to slaughter his son. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. He said, here I am. He said, do not lay your hand on the boy or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, seeing that you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. So I kind of revealed it already, but why do you think Abraham was able to pass this test? his faith. He trusted in God, right? He had trust of God, and his trust allowed him to pass the test that God gave him. Abraham did this. As our coins say, in God we trust, right? And Abraham actually came up with that a long time before our money, apparently. And it's because in God, Abraham trusted, and so he was willing to go through whatever God asked him to do, no matter what. But through Abraham's life, though, it seems like this was a lesson that was hard learned. This was not always sort of the attitude of Abraham, was it, if you know any of his story. There are several things he didn't do very well along the way. He had sort of a journey to go in learning to trust God. Back in Genesis chapter 12, he passed sort of the first test, the very, very first thing. Genesis chapter 12, God calls Abraham out of the blue, seemingly. Chapter 12, verse 1 through 4, it says, "Now the Lord said to Abram," Abraham is also Abraham, "go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. And I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed." So Abram went, as the Lord had told him, and Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. So God tells Abraham, leave your family, leave your land, go to a new place. I'm gonna kind of start fresh with you. And Abraham, who was 75 years old then, said, do you think he had some roots, like, laid down at where he was? Probably, since, you know, he's past retirement age. He doesn't want to go on this journey and start a whole new life, probably. I don't know, maybe not. But he picks up and moves, and that's pretty trusting of God, right? I think that's fairly trusting. We might notice, though, that even though he's told to leave his father's family, his nephew Lot still comes along. So I don't know if that was a kink in the trust or not. It's not really clear. We're not sure. But still, he's very trusting of God in that. But then just fast forward just a few verses later, and you get the story in chapter 12 again, verse 10 through 13. This is a story here. It says, "Now there was famine in the land. So Abram went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was severe in the land. When he was about to enter Egypt, he said to Sarai, his wife, I know that you're a woman beautiful in appearance, and when the Egyptians see you, they will say, this is his wife. Then they will kill me, but they will let you live. Say you are my sister, that it may go well with me because of you, and that my life may be spared for your sake." So there's a famine in the land that God said, I'm going to take care of you here and promise you and make you prosper, and there's a famine, so Abram leaves. He goes to Egypt. While in Egypt, he gets scared because apparently his wife is so incredibly beautiful that at the age of 65, maybe a few years older by now, I don't know, she's so beautiful that he says, if anyone asks you, we are not married, tell them we're just brother and sister because they're going to kill me to get you. And so just tell them I'm your brother and maybe I'll get some profit out of this. Like, that's actually what he said. Husbands in the room, have you ever tried this? Been like, dear, you are so beautiful that, you know what, if anybody asks, just tell them you're not married and we'll sell you to the highest bidder. Like, that's what he did there. That's what he did it again another time in his life, too. Is that what a trusting guy who trusts God does? No, not at all. That's not what someone who follows a God is faithful and trusts of God does. But Abraham did it. You know, he's on this journey. He's learning the lesson. Hasn't quite learned it yet. And he failed that test there. Another test, the test of patience, he had to figure out, and he kind of failed that one too. Remember that he had to wait until he was 100 years old to get a son? He kind of got impatient along the way, his wife as well. In Genesis chapter 16, we learn, now Sarai, Abram's wife, the first verses of chapter 16, now Sarai, Abram's wife, had borne him no children. She had a female Egyptian servant whose name was Hagar, and Sarai said to Abram, behold now, the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. Go into my servant. It may be that I shall obtain children by her. And Abram listened to the voice of Sarai. Now, out of wedlock, possibly, probably, and I know it's terrible to say, but through rape, because she was a servant, it happened back then, but it was still terrible. It doesn't make it better that it happened back then. Abraham and Hagar had Ishmael. And if you look into it, that caused a whole host of problems, didn't it? Kind of still has repercussions today, doesn't it? He failed that test, and it caused some issues there. I think it's safe to say Abram was still a work in progress, right? He was learning. He was making some big mistakes along the way, but he's learning this lesson of trusting God. But thankfully, he passed some tests along the way, too. I mean, number one, he left his homeland. Another one we get to in Genesis chapter 14. where it seems like he passes a test. I think Genesis chapter 14 is a really neat story because you learn a couple details about Abraham you would have never guessed otherwise. Like, did you know Abraham had his own personal army that traveled around with him? Like, that's, I think that's cool, but it's apparently it happened. He had his own personal army. We learn that in Genesis chapter 14. And chapter 14 begins by listing a whole host of names that are really hard to say, and they're just hard to pronounce, which is what a lot of biblical names are, but these ones are the worst. And so you get to these ones, and it's all this list of kings, they're enemies with this list of kings, and they're vassals against with each other, and they decide to rebel, and they get into a fight, and Abram's nephew, Lot, lives in the middle of all of it, and he gets captured, becomes a prisoner of war, because he gets caught up in all the fighting. So Abraham, being a good uncle, just calls up his army, and they go to war against these kings to go save his nephew, Lot. Abraham joins the war, and they lay the smackdown on the bad guys. Right? Like, he just decimates them. He has no problem at all fighting them. He wins, and he gets all the spoils of the war, right? Like, that's what happened back then. You defeat someone's army, you get all their stuff. And so he gets all their stuff, and then the weirdest thing in verse 17 happens, 17 and following. After his return from the defeat of Kedorlaomer and the kings who were with him, the king of Sodom went out to meet him at the valley of Shaveh, that is, the king's valley. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was priest of God Most High, and he blessed him and said, "Blessed be Abram by God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand." And Abram gave him a tenth of everything. Now, Melchizedek is never mentioned before this ever, and he's not really ever mentioned after this except for two passing references that are very strange and enigmatic in their own ways, and it's just strange, Melchizedek, this character. But here's what we do know about him, that his name, we learn from this passage at least, his name, Melchizedek, is from two compound Hebrew words, Melech, which means king, and Zedek, which means righteousness. So he's Melchizedek. So his name is literally King of Righteousness. That's an interesting name, I think. He's also the king of Salem. Have you heard of Salem before? Not just the one down the road, but Salem is the original name of Jerusalem. Jeru is new. New Salem. Jerusalem. So he's the king. And what is the city of Jerusalem for? It's the capital city of what? Of God's people. So he's the king of the city where God's people is their capital. His name is King of Righteousness. And then he breaks bread and wine with Abraham, which is vaguely familiar of something that doesn't occur for another couple thousand years, but it reminds us a lot of something that happened about 2,000 years ago about breaking bread and wine that we do every time we gather. And he does that. And so we really have no clue who Melchizedek is. He's this weirdest, enigmatic, we don't know what's going on thing. But it's pretty obvious that at the very least, he's a strong representative figure for God in the story, right? At the very least. His name is King of Righteousness, and he's the king of Jerusalem. So he at least represents God in some form or fashion, and what does Abraham do for him? Abraham just won a battle with his own personal army. He just made a whole lot of money. And what did he do with the money? Did he keep it all? He gives a tenth to this representative of God, doesn't he? He gave a tenth to a God. Basically, he paid a tithe is what that is called. A tithe is the old English word for tenth. That's just what it means. It's not a fancy word. It just means tenth. It's just another way of saying the word tenth. Tithe is 10%. And this was a long time before the Old Testament law of Moses, isn't it? Because Moses doesn't come for hundreds of years later. So before the law, tithes are happening. And Abraham just somehow knows that 10% is the right amount to give to thank God for the battle. And just while I'm on the note of the tithe, I want to clarify a couple things. Number one, and this is something I've waffled a little bit on, but the more I study it and the more I think about it, the more I look at it, I'm thinking it's not just some Old Testament law commandment to follow the tithe. It's not. I'm pretty sure it's supposed to be a standard for all of God's people during this lifetime. I mean, we see that because, number one, Abraham did it before the Old Testament law, right? He gave 10% of his proceeds. And then it happens a lot throughout the Old Testament law. Later in the Old Testament law, God says the way you rob him is by not paying the tithe. And then you get to the New Testament, and Jesus in Matthew 23:23 says you're supposed to pay a tithe. He says it's an expectation to pay the tithe. Jesus said that. So that's interesting, I think. The New Testament passage where it's our proof text to not have to pay tithes nowadays, where it says each of you should give in your heart as he has decided to give. You know, like you're just supposed to decide amount between you and God. That's not about giving offerings regularly to the church or the kingdom work. If you read the context of that passage, I've used that passage too to decide you don't need a tithe, but as I study it, I decide I was wrong. Because the context of that passage is Paul is writing to the church in Corinth saying, take up a love offering. That's what he's saying. He's saying there's the Jerusalem church, they're starving, they need money, there are people going hungry. Can you guys decide what's right in your heart to give so we can give them a one-time special offering? That's what's happening in the book of 2 Corinthians. It's a love offering being taken for a special mission project. And so that's an exception. The standard that we see elsewhere, though, is this tenth thing. Then, therefore, that leads you to number two about tithing, that tithing, giving 10% of your income, is not an act of generosity. It's not. It's an act of obedience. Giving beyond 10% is an act of generosity because it would hurt to give more than 10%, right? You're going to feel it. And so then it's actually generosity. That's generosity, not giving 10%. It's obedience is just tithing there. And then also just another thing to clarify, you can't tithe less than 10% of your income. You can't tithe more than 10% of your income. You can't. Tithe is 10%. That's what the word means. You can give more or less, but that's giving an offering. That's not tithing. And so just a clarification on that word. I've joked often with some people. I think it's hilarious, but I've wanted to put on the church sign, this month's special, tithe only 8%. Because I think that'd be great. I know a pastor who did that. He had it up for long enough to take the picture, and then he changed it. But one day I want to be brave enough to do that. But let me reassure you, though, I'm not preaching about offering and tithing because we need money. Ridgeview is actually doing awesome this year. Ridgeview, its giving is exceeding the budget. I haven't looked in old records, but of recent history in the last like 10 years or so that I have numbers without having to ask and dig for them, we are setting a record year in giving. So I'm not teaching on giving because it's necessary. I teach on giving, actually. I try to every November because of the month of Thanksgiving, and when you're thankful, you should show God you're thankful. And so that's why I try to teach on giving in November. But I'm preaching about offering and tithing, and I schedule it in Novembers because I'm supposed to preach the whole counsel of God, and it's in the counsel of God. It's before the law, it's during the law, it's after the law. Jesus said it. We're supposed to be generous and obedient. And so that's why I bring it up. Further, just to clarify any worries, I am not targeting you or anyone here because I have no idea what individuals give. I don't know how much you give. Unless you've walked up to me and told me directly, then I don't know how much you give to Ridgeview. I've never seen the numbers. The same amount of detail you get for giving is what I get. Inside the bulletin where it says how much was given last week and what we're doing so far in the year, that's the amount of detail I have. I get to see the extra of like the budget of each line item in the budget of how much was spent. But that's spending, that's not giving. I have no idea what the giving is from individuals here. I know how many people gave total, but that's like where my detail ends. I know the national average, though, the national average of Christians who do give to the churches they go to, this is not counting the zero percenters, so they're not setting off the scale terribly, it's just of those who give anything, the national average is of those who give, they give 2.5% of their household income. That's the national average of what is given to the church of those who do give. So you realize if we're average, and I don't think we're average, I've got reason to believe I think we're above average is my hunch, but if we were just average for the sake of argument and easy math, if we started tithing everyone who gives, not the ones who aren't giving, just the ones who currently are giving, we would fourfold our current budget. Four times over is what our budget would be. And then if you added on those who aren't giving at all and they started giving, we'd surpass $1 million pretty easily. Now, it's not about numbers, it's not about big numbers or fancy numbers, but a lot of things take numbers. And couldn't you do a whole lot for the community and for the kingdom around the world with $1 million budget? Probably could. I know of ways that if we could just bless someone just like that, it would be great. It's not about money, but you know, it's a tool in this life, and the way God's asked us to be obedient could make the tool a lot more fun to use sometimes. But it goes back to that lesson, right? The lesson that Abram had trouble learning. Lesson that we sometimes have trouble learning. And that's that lesson of, have we trusted in God? It says it on our money. The money that we've got the most problems with this lesson sometimes, the money itself is reminding us the lesson, right? Where if you sit down and read the money, it says, in God we trust. Like even our money's telling us it's okay. And so we need to trust God on that. I can put the issue simply with just a few questions. Does paying a tithe ever seem like a hard test? Yeah. Thank you for being honest. It sometimes feels like a hard test. Is that test ever one you'll pass if you have no trust in God? No, you're not going to. Think about this, though. Which was the bigger test for Abraham? Was it sacrificing his only son, or was it paying a 10% of his increase? I would hope it was a harder test to sacrifice his son than it was to get rid of some of his money, right? Like, you would hope that's the harder test. If it doesn't, Abraham had some major soul issues, right? And hopefully we don't have that too. But think back to Hebrews chapter 11. Why did Abraham have enough trust in God that it was okay to sacrifice his son? What did he believe God would do? He thought he would raise Isaac from the dead. Doesn't that sound a whole lot like our faith? Being raised from the dead? It is. Isn't that what Christianity is? Like, having the faith that God will raise you from the dead, to believe that Jesus died in your place, and so death no longer has a sting, it no longer hurts, it's been defeated, that though we may die, we'll get raised again to newness of life. Like, isn't that Christianity? And then you give your life to him, and everything about your life you want to live following after Jesus because he gave his life for you, so you give his life to him. That's Christianity, right? And so wait a minute, if we trust God with our entire lives and trust that he'll raise us from the dead, why are we not able to trust him with 10% of our income? Right? Which one's a bigger deal, our life or 10% of our stuff? Hopefully our life is a bigger deal. I hope none of us put a tithe ahead of the resurrection of the dead on how much trust it takes in your life. And you might say, it would take a miracle for me to live off of 90% of my income. It would take a miracle for you to raise from the dead too, right? It would. Especially, think about this. There are Christians who died like 2,000 years ago almost, and like even just a few hundred years ago. They're fully decomposed, right? But we're expecting that when Jesus comes back, he's going to raise their bodies out of the grave and they're going to experience newness of life with fully recreated bodies, right? If God can reanimate a fully decomposed dead body, do you think you could get by with 90% of your income if God's involved? Yeah. If God's involved, you can do this. Their miracles can happen. If he can do the harder one, he can probably do the easier one too. And so back when Abraham was asked to sacrifice his son, he was put to a test, right? He had learned the lesson that he needs to trust in God. No matter how hard or how crazy the task may sound, no matter whether or not it's going to take a miracle for him to survive the test, he had to get through that test of trusting in God. And it might have taken him some failures to learn the lesson, but in the end, we see he did learn it, and he follows through on that one. And basically, his test was this very simple question. It was basically one question. It was, Abraham, do you love your son more than the reason why you have a son? Worded slightly differently, do you love the gift of a son more than you love the giver of your son? Worded more simply, it's, do you love the gift more than you love the giver? We could be asked the same question. Do you love the gift more than you love the giver? Or do you trust the giver more than you trust the gift? Do you trust in having 100% of the gifts that the giver has given you more than you trust the giver himself to give you more? Hopefully you don't trust the gift more. See, our tithes declare that we trust the King of Righteousness and the King of the New Jerusalem, that we're going to make it through no matter what. If we are obedient to God, then he can open the storehouses and we're going to be okay. That's what our tithes declares, that we're trusting in him. And it might hurt, but obeying God sometimes hurts. And it's hopefully, no matter how hard or crazy it might sound, we should have the trust to just obey him, to simply trust in his directions that he's given us for his life. And that applies to so much more than money, but that's the topic we're on right now. It applies to everything and how you should trust in God. But God gives us a test. And do you trust him to raise you from the dead? Real question, do you trust God to raise you from the dead? That's really sad. More and more people hopefully believe that. Maybe you're just introverts and you just don't want to say yes out loud. But I trust God to raise me from the dead, and I hope you do too. If you don't, we can talk about God raising you from the dead when we stand and sing in just a couple minutes, like for real. Come and talk to me, or even after the service and talk to me, because God has promised he'll raise you from the dead if you trust in him. And so hopefully you trust in him to raise you from the dead. And if you trust him with your life, why wouldn't you trust him with your finances too? Isn't that a piece of your life? Less than your total life? I hope you don't believe finances are bigger than your life. So trust him with that. Let's tell God we trust him by obeying and doing what he tells us to do. Let's pray. God, we thank you that you have given us examples in your scripture, sometimes examples to learn what not to do, sometimes examples to learn what to do. So God, we want to be obedient and trusting of you no matter what your directions sound like for this life, even if our culture or something in our spirits tell us that it's not a good idea, may we be trusting of your directions. May we be trust you with our whole lives, even maybe if we've got anger about being told what we need to give or being told that we may not be as generous, but may we give that anger to you as well, because God, we know you can handle it. We are a God who can handle all things. And we are excited and thankful that you are going to handle our whole lives. And so God, may we give our lives to you in full dedication, everything about us. We say this in Jesus' name, amen.